This is Daniel McFadden, the co-host and co-writer of the Orsini Tapes, back again for yet another bonus episode. This time, we are bringing you an interview I conducted with Tom Carpenter late last year. Tom Carpenter, for the last 40 years, has served as the city attorney for Little Rock. But before that, he had the misfortune of serving as one of the attorneys for Mary Lee Orsini during her murder trial in October of 1982. And it was not a great experience, as you will soon find out. He talks briefly with me about his background and how he got involved in the case and how it was a nightmare from start to finish. So here is my interview with Little Rock City Attorney and former Mary Lee Orsini lawyer, Tom Carpenter.
All right, so middle of 1982, May 21st, the attempted car bombing of Alice MacArthur's car. Mm-hmm. What was your, do you remember anything about that and finding out about it or anything like that?
Well, we found out about it because it was on the news immediately. The question was, why did it happen? Mm-hmm. That is just an incredibly unusual thing to happen. You don't have mm-hmm. things like that happening. And why was it Alice MacArthur? I think it was probably about that time that I found out that Alice was somehow related to a family in New Orleans that either was or worked with or knew a family that was involved in organized crime in New Orleans. And so then I hope I'm not mixing the two situations, the car bombing and her actual murder. But there was this sort of back channel of, is this somehow related to organized crime? I don't think I am, but I cannot tell you that I'm not, if that helps or doesn't help. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. trying to be straightforward.
Yeah.
I know that when she was killed, that there is a situation where the contact or the connection with the New Orleans criminal element did get mentioned enough. And in my building, there were, I mean, Jack and I had a law partnership there. There were a couple of other lawyers there, one who was named Bob Laster. And one day Bob was in his office and, you know, everybody was pretty congenial. What do you got going? What's going here? And he suddenly met this man at the back of the office and took him into his door and closed it and never talked to us. And we never knew what that was about. Well, finally he told us that what it was about is that they had sent somebody up from New Orleans to find why the family's name was being mentioned so much and it in relation to Alice MacArthur's death. So that was after the murder, but I think that the information or that she is connected or something like that came up after the car bombing. Mm. And, you know, then we just kind of went on our way.
So she's actually murdered July 2nd, 1982.
Right. He was getting ready to go to Fourth of July weekend up on a lake someplace. I think she had bought him a new swimsuit or something.
Mm-hmm. So, and then Mary Lee Orsini and Yankee, and then they all get arrested. So how does Tom Carpenter and his colleagues, how do you guys get pulled into this web?
Well, there were real names in the criminal defense community in Central Arkansas at that time. One of them was Bill MacArthur. One of them was Jack Hope Jr., who eventually became the Chief Justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court. One was Jack Lessenberry, my law partner. There was a guy named Harold Hall. There was a guy named Gene Worthen. I mean, but there weren't that many. Mm. And when the thing happened, Lee Orsini got involved with it because she worked with, I think it was a real estate agent, and made a fake phone call tape about, you know, not being involved and why are you doing this, which was supposedly a reenactment of the phone call she actually had. And that's how she got arrested. And I don't really remember how Yankee and the other guy got arrested, but I can't remember his name.
Larry McClendon.
Larry McClendon. Larry had the public defender representing him, and I don't know how, but the Miss Orsini contacted Jack, and then Jack asked if I wanted to work on it with him, and I was doing a lot of, I told you I was doing a lot of death penalty work, and there was an awful lot of, you know, really intense research issues going around. They hadn't decided at that time what was the standard for effective assistance of counsel. They hadn't decided whether or not death qualification of a jury made it prosecution prone to the point that it would end up being a due process violation. And so there was a lot of that going on, and I think that's why Jack asked me to help.
Okay. So when's the first time, do you remember the first time you met Mary Lee?
I remember the first time I met her. I don't remember the day. She was in the Pulaski County Jail, and I went out with Jack, and we chatted with her. And then there was a hearing on whether she would get bail or not, and bail was initially denied. And I don't think she ever got bail. In Arkansas, the thing on bail, and I had this from a case I'd been involved with in Northwest Arkansas, they denied bail because the man was accused shooting a police officer, and they challenged it all the way to the state Supreme Court because the Constitution says that you don't get bail in a capital case unless the evidence is clear and the presumption is great, something like that. And so James Redren was that case. And in this case, you know, in the Redren case, they may or may not have had a hair from a burned out car that belonged to him. In this case, they had the phone call. They had her going out of her way to say she wasn't involved. And then I really don't remember if Yankee Hall said she was, or if McClendon didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And what always kind of struck me is that this thing was so, everywhere you looked, there was something in the news media about the Orsini case. And in part because of Alice MacArthur's wife, in part because she had been charged or she had been accused of a murder before, and then a no true bill was given. Mm-hmm. And now it's back here. And then the story of, well, Mrs. MacArthur was killed so that Mary Lee could be with Bill, that this was some sort of thing they were supposed to have. And you know, the indication was Bill didn't have any relationship with Mary Lee except that he knew her. But, you know, we kept getting stories back and forth as to what was the nature of that relationship and how long ongoing it had been. And then it really kind of got ridiculous. And we started getting all these stories about relationships with everybody else in the city. And it was just kind of bizarre. And she was dating a veterinarian.
Mm, Dr. Wells.
Yeah, who was really kind of small looking, very nice gentleman. But, you know, supposedly she was dating major politicians and major lawyers and all these, you know, high society people. And it didn't seem to be the case. In any event, we met together at the jail. Jack did the talking and I introduced myself.
So what was your impression of her at that meeting?
She seemed personable. She didn't seem to be as concerned as I think a person should be if they're charged with capital murder.
Was that a red flag? Back in your mind?
No, because it wasn't a red flag because I didn't know her. I had nothing mm-hmm. to compare it to, except people I had represented who had been charged with murder. But in their cases, there were like witnesses and confessions and all this other stuff. And I clerked for circuit judges in the course of capital cases, and there was all kind of evidence. And so it was a different kind of makeup. So it kind of struck me as it's a little bit odd. She indicated she was going to be very helpful with us, and she talked to us and said she would do anything we told her, and she didn't. And it just something didn't ring right. It just didn't make sense. I mean, what was the big thing in my mind? Why would somebody do a take saying they're not involved if they're not involved? Even if somebody called you and said you're not involved, why would you go out of your way to let everybody know you're not involved? I mean, there's something there that didn't just sit right. So that was all.
No, nobody was talking about you, and then you started talking about yourself.
Yeah, sort of like that. Well, and the lieutenant that found it, I asked him during the course of the thing, you know, said, how did this happen? And he said, you know, it's kind of funny. I just was listening around. I kept hearing this voice, and I kind of had an idea that I've heard that voice before. And he somehow put it within a particular category of employment. I think the guy was a real estate agent or
Larry Bird.
And he started calling real estate agencies until Burge answered the phone. And then there it was.
Wow. Okay. All right. So this initial, after this initial meeting, what was like the process of getting ready for that trial?
Well, the first thing we were trying to do is to see if we could get bail. We looked at issues of changing venue. We tried to, you know, get the hold of the evidence and look through it and see what was there and what was not there. It was pretty clear she didn't kill anybody personally. But, you know, what was going on? And then the other part of it is that in Arkansas, there's an accomplice corroboration rule, I think it's probably in other states, where if the evidence that they have against you that you committed a crime is only the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice, then that's not sufficient to convict. So we were looking at all of the theories and the cases that dealt with that, and how would we present the evidence, and how would we go about it?
When she, I guess, shared her story with you, like what was her version of?
She didn't do it.
She didn't?
No, okay. She didn't have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't involved. During the course of the thing, we came to find out about she and Dr. Wolves. Yeah. And things kept coming back up from the death of her husband, and you know, what was that about? What was not about? All of that was going on, and then somewhere pretty closely in, we started getting information that she was talking to the sheriff. And I know that there was one meeting with me and Jack and her and the sheriff, and the sheriff, Tommy Robinson, was saying, "I'm going to put you in jail if I can prove that you did it." And she said, "I think you should, and I expect you to do that. Go right ahead." And you know, it was a very surreal conversation, and we were given this "don't talk to her unless one of us is present." And I know that at one time I went to see her at the jail, and I tried to go relatively often, just because I know what it's like to be in jail and not see anybody, and even if I couldn't say anything except, "Gee, nothing's going on," or "we're doing this," or whatever. And one day I was on the way to see her, and as I was walking to the pod that she was in, she was being taken to Tommy Robinson's office. And I said, "Okay, I'm going too." "Well, you can't go. She's going to the sheriff." I said, "I sure can go." And I went. And then I'm sure that the conversation that we had at that time, just the three of us, was stilted. You know, I mean, it didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. We heard about an alleged trip to Dallas that she took with Tommy Robinson while she was in jail. They brought her to our offices a couple of times. But it's like we were nailing jello to the wall. I mean, you know, every time we thought we had a handle on something, something would come up, and it was just a nightmare.
So compared to everything else you've dealt with in your career, how did this case, like, just compare?
Well, it didn't make sense. I mean, there was nothing to indicate that she had a relationship. There was no reason to figure out why Mrs. MacArthur was dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole thing was sad. I mean, it's like she's getting ready to go on 4th of July weekend. People show up at her door. She runs to get into a closet, hides.
Mm-hmm.
They keep going everywhere. They finally find her, and she gets shot in the back of the head and killed. And there was absolutely nothing to suggest why that had happened. And it never became evident. So then I think everybody was looking for, well, why is she dead? Well, so he can be free and marry Lee Orsini and he can get together. But, you know, we never got anything that indicate that had he been free, he would have turned to Mary Lee Orsini for anything.
Mm-hmm.
The most we ever heard is that he owned a place called BJ's Honky Tonk at the time. Yeah. I don't know what it's called now.
Well, it was turned into the Electric Cowboy, but it closed down years ago.
I think I was there once in my entire life, but and it was after the trial. But, you know, we got some information that he had danced with her there, but you know, this was like Texas two-step dancing and everybody's going sort of around in a circle doing the same two things and all that. So it's like you see on movies, you go to a ball and the ladies have a dance list, and when it stands 14, you dance with them and then you go off to the next person. I mean, we had nothing to indicate that there was any relationship between the two of them. And that everything seemed to be, you know, in her mind. And as everybody was doing this, oh, well, it was done so that the two of them could be together. They went after Bill. He got arrested. I don't know exactly what happened, but I know he got released. But, I mean, it was like, there's no reason for Mrs. MacArthur to be dead. So that's the thing in all the cases that I've done that bothers me. Where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
What was this about? You know, Miss Orsini died and she was in prison and she had found Christ and she was supposedly being this good influence for everybody down at the prison. And yet, you know, shortly before she died, there was this sort of one last slap at Bill. This is the reason that it happened. And by that time, I had decided that any similarity between anything she said and the truth was a mere coincidence.
So the trial, like, so you guys gear up for the trial. Like, how do you get ready for that with a witness who's weird and kind of nailing jello to the wall?
She wasn't nailing jello to the wall. We were once. Well, two things happened that were particularly difficult. I mean, I had a kind of Jesus meeting with her after not the time when I was pulled and went into the office with the sheriff and her, but another time after that, you know, I had a real, you can't talk to these people. These people are not your friends. They may be bringing you in here and trying to let you know they're not trying to get information, but all they're trying to do is to get you into prison. And I didn't think much of it because, you know, I'd had to say it to other defendants in the past. Evidently, I said it well enough because word came back to me from one of my other clients. He said, well, I don't know what you did to her, but it's to talk to the whole jail. you know, just kind of came down there and don't do this. But things kept happening. And, like, I'm trying to remember the time frame. We started trial on Monday, like Thursday afternoon or Friday, maybe Wednesday, we were handed a stack of transcripts of telephone conversations between her and Sheriff Robinson and people on Sheriff Robinson's staff. And so here we're getting ready to go into a defense and we've been working on everything. And now we find that our client's been saying all this stuff with the sheriff. So we go to the judge and
And we basically file a motion under seal that says we need to be taken off this case because we really have a problem with this client. We've told her, don't talk to people. We've seen her taken places, to meaning the sheriff's office. I don't know if she went to Dallas or not. I kind of find that to be fantastical. But, you know, and then we get these 30 pages or whatever it was of comments of what she had been saying to these people and how she was going to help them find stuff that was supposed to be able to get this whole case taken away. Tommy Robinson wanted Bill MacArthur. And the judge wouldn't let us off. And so now we've got a real hell of a dilemma. Among other things, you know, you can't put a client on the stand and let them lie. If you think they're supposed to lie, the ethical thinking at the time was, do you have something to say? And you don't really direct them. They just say whatever it is they want to say, which tells everybody that they're not telling the truth. There is a thing in the record where it came time for her to go to the judge and testify that she wasn't going to testify and that she had talked to us about it. She understood what our reasons were and you know, she agreed with them. And it was kind of I agree with them, but gee, I really would like to testify. But that, and we're not getting into on the record, by the way, we got these 30 pages of documents, which came up and it was just the most bizarre situation. I mean, I know that I think Chris Piazza, who was the prosecutor, his last witness, if I'm correct, in the case in chief, was the real estate agent and the playing of the tape.
Mm.
And he set up the playing of the tape so he had a foundation. And then he played the whole thing. So you had the back and forth and back and forth, and there's a transcript. And you know, she acted the part, sounded great. Who is this? Why are you saying this about me? You know, I can't believe you're doing it. You know, she had all the theatrics in it. And then the tape stopped, and the courtroom was silent. And he said the defense rest, or the state rest. And you know, we're still silent. And then we get into the, okay, we're going to break until so-and-so and so-and-so. And so we had a break. I don't remember if we broke for a meal or if we broke for a period of time. What I remember is there was a little office. We were in what is the bankruptcy court now. At the time, it was the law school. And they had a mock courtroom in there for trial practice courses. And there were a couple of offices off to the side. And we had been given one because, you know, we couldn't, like, take her back to our office or anything. And she was in there, and she was looking out the window. And I remember I told Jack later, I said, you know, the look on her face when she was looking out the window after that tape had ended was like, for the first time, she recognized this wasn't a joke, that this was serious. It's like she finally realized that this is a problem. And I kind of, you know, I mean, it was just, it's like that was the first time. Then, you know, we get through the rest of the trial, we get through the closings. My part of the closing was to deal with the complex corroboration rule. My last line was, after going through what the law part of it was, is that because in this state, we don't convict people on the testimony of scum. That was my last line. Never made the newspaper. I thought, you know, I'm good stop coming up with last lines. But, and then Jack, you know, did his thing. And Chris, Jack was really a great trial lawyer. And Chris kept interrupting him and objecting to stuff. And you know, some of the objections may have been technically okay. A bunch of them were just not. And you know, Jack was saying, I just want to make my argument. And And then Chris got up there, and at the very beginning of the trial, Chris had written all this stuff on the blackboard, you know, how we're going to prove this web of deception and the Black Widow and all that. And then Jack got up, and he didn't have an eraser, so he took his jacket off, his suit coat off, and he erased the board. Well, so we had written some stuff on the board or something during closing, and Chris did that at the beginning of his rebuttal closing argument. People in the courtroom cheered, and the court called him down, and, you know. But it had become kind of the circus, and then the jury came back.
So I think it was like a two-day trial or what, something like that for the most part. So you're sitting there in the courtroom.
Was that all it was?
It was short. It was short.
It wasn't long.
It was short. But so you're sitting there in the courtroom doing your best to defend this woman. So in Tom Carpenter's head, was she guilty or not guilty? Like, what were you doing, like, in the moment? You're like, I think she did it.
Well, I learned pretty early on that if you get yourself carried away with that question and your defense counsel, you just can't do anything. And I had done work in other homicide cases, some of which were really vicious. I'd been appointed by the Supreme Court to deal with an appeal of a guy that lined up a bunch of kids working in a Safeway in Fayetteville and blew their heads off. Unfortunately, one of them didn't get their head for him. One of them didn't get their head blown off and lived to identify. And you know, you can't do that work ethically if you get yourself carried away with, oh my God, what's going to happen to this person? What I learned on is that the defendant was a fact. And how did the fact fit in with the other facts in the law and the case? I mean, I know that sounds disassociative, but that's the only way I could do it. And so, no, I wasn't sitting there, you know, thinking, is she going to get convicted? Is she not going to get convicted? I was pretty sure after the scene I told you about, where she was looking out the window, after that scene, I didn't have any doubt she was going to get convicted. If there was a question, it was there anything really to connect her with it except Yankee Hall? And if there wasn't, then a jury might acquit her. Or deadlock. You might get a deadlock, and that might open up some opportunities. But she gets convicted, and I remember it was night from the jury verdict came in, and you know, you do all the stuff, and I told her that I would come out to talk to her the next day, because by that time I'd learned about being in prison a little bit, not from having been there, but from things that other clients had told me. And I wanted to give her some of the tips I knew, like, you know, people offer you something, they're not being nice, don't accept it. Stay to yourself. Keep your nose clean. Keep out of other people's business. And so on. But, you know, Jack and I went over to the what was then the Canalot, and we were trying to relax. And remember Pong? I think it was Atari Pong. Yeah. It was like a tabletop. It was a tennis game. We did that a few times, and while we had a drink and tried to make some sort of sense of it. And
this is before or after the?
This is after the verdict.
After they announced it?
After it was out, okay. After she'd been taken away. And there was no sense to be made. The whole thing, it wasn't just senseless, it was just absurd. You know, I mean, most homicides in this country at least have some sort of connection to them. And one reason that a lot of people who commit homicide, except the guys from the mafia who do it on a regular basis, are not repetitive is because they've got a relation. You know, it's a couple broke up, and she's dating somebody else. I mean, or this person's always been mean to me or whatever it is. None of that was here.
And I don't really remember sleeping well or anything that night. What I remember is getting up the next morning, and I was wondering if they were getting ready to rush her down to the prison. Typically, they wouldn't, but, you know, this was such a high-profile thing, and everybody was pleased with it. Would they do that? So I called to the jail because I was trying to set up a meeting, and she called me back, and I started into my, there's some things you need to know. And she said, well, no, you need to listen to me. You need to listen to me. I'm turning state's evidence against Bill MacArthur, and we've hired Tom something from
Donovan
from the Yaleville or that part of the woods, Moralton, someplace around there, and he's going to represent me now. And I'm sitting there thinking, just when I thought nothing could get even hotter, they got hotter. I mean, you know, I don't know what he's going to do. What do you mean you're going to turn state's evidence? Do you mean that, you know, nothing you've ever told us was the truth? I mean, that's exactly what I thought. And then, you know, we were relieved, and Donovan started doing his stuff, and it just continued to be bizarre.
So since your part of that was over, so what was it like watching the rest of it, I guess, play out from a distance, having been in that orbit for a certain amount of time?
Jack Lassinger called. Somewhere in this whole process, and he had said, you know, there's not a lot of us that do these kinds of cases, and you know, you've been taken away from. I mean, the deal with criminal defense work is you either get paid or you don't get paid.
Well, that's going to be a question, because Mary Lee Orsini notoriously was broke. From all of this, it was like, how was she?
I don't know, Jack. God, Jack and I had a deal. I had been out of law school, and he and I had a deal that I would get a certain amount a month, and that was to pay for peanut butter and a car note and my apartment. It wasn't much. It was $750 a month. It was really an ideal at this point. And then every 3 months, we'd see what I had done and what I brought in.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pay back the $750 a month, and if there's anything left over, he would let me keep that. And we did that for a couple of years. So we were still doing that. So I never saw any money and never cared to see any money. But the thing about doing criminal defense work is, you know, if that's the primary part of your business, you've got to keep getting work in. And so when, even though it was a short time between the arrest and the trial, and we didn't extend anything, you know, that's 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks that you're not taking new cases. You can't go try DWI defense, which could bring you, you know, a month's rent. And so that was there. And he said, you know, we've all had a problem, and if you need something, you know, let me know. I'll be happy to cover for you. And then what I found out is that all of the lawyers that were involved in that case, except the public defenders, their practices dried up for a substantial period of time. And it was like 6 or 8 months before, or longer before, you know, things really started coming back.
Because you couldn't pay.
Well, yeah, but it, you know, people weren't coming to me because they had a DWI. They weren't coming to me for a divorce. They weren't coming to me for anything. It was like I had the plague, and Bill had the plague, and Jack got hit by it. And, you know, it was just Jack Lesenberry and Jack Lassiter both. You know, it was a real.
You think it's because, oh, wow, he defended her. Why would I want that person representing me? Was it that kind of thing?
No, I think it was just, I don't know what it was, because there was no reason to do that to Bill MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jack Lesenberry had a reputation going back
30 years. He had been to the U.S. Supreme Court. He had been one of the attorney generals. He had been a prosecutor. He was respected throughout the state. It was just a strange time.
Okay. So 1983, Orsini goes to trial again for the murder of her husband. From a distance watching that play out, what was that like, and seeing her get convicted, or at least for a short period of time, convicted again?
I guess the best way I can answer that is this. During the representation on the MacArthur stuff, we ended up having a lot of conversations about the death of her husband.
With Mary Lee,
talked to the Orsini.
Okay.
And we were told lots of things. Mm-hmm. And the things we were told were not things that were coming out of that trial. About as far as I can go.
Okay. All right. So 20 some odd years later, in 2003, she makes her confession and, you know, dies, I think, just a few weeks later. So when that confession came out, what was Tom Carpenter's?
Oh, I just thought it was a lie. I was a little surprised because she had indicated and had been acting as if she had a very devout religious experience. A lot of people do in jail. Paul, the apostle, did. But I was just kind of, okay, it's one last hit, you know. I think that her overall demeanor is that she never did anything wrong. People always did something to her. Mm-hmm. And so it was consistent with that.
Okay. So 40 some odd years later, looking back on your brief window of time to associate with this woman, what's the lasting, I guess, legacy of this whole chain of events, either on your career or just in general?
Well, if I really think about the case, the first thing that hits me is a deep sadness that Alice MacArthur is dead and I could never figure out why. I mean, even in some of the murder cases I handled where the death penalty was on the table, I could at least understand why there had been a murder. I have never understood it here, and I never will. I saw the press frenzy. They wanted information about everything. I've never had a client that acted like they were, oh, my life's on the line. I'm going to do everything you can tell me to do. I'm going to behave everything, all that, and then turn around and not. Mm-hmm. I've never had a client lie to me like that. I mean, I'm not doing anything. I'm not talking to Tommy Robinson. And then here's this 30-page or more list of transcripts. I think Chris Piazza went on to be an incredible circuit judge. I know he was up to be a federal judge at one point. And I think that Arkansas, the person that was appointed when his name was up, was an incredible circuit judge. But you know, Chris would have been a fantastic federal district judge. I think he recognized that we did what we could in cases, not just her case, and that we wouldn't blow smoke or tell lies. It wasn't worth it. You know, if you can't get an acquittal because the state can't prove its case or your client's innocent, mm-hmm. then you don't make up stuff. There were no plan Bs like the practice where you suddenly put it off on somebody else.
Mm.
And it wasn't that long after all of this was over with that I got the phone call. I mean, did I say that at the beginning? No. Well, I think I said it. Maybe I didn't.
I don't remember.
My wife told me we were having our first child. My partner told me that he was running for judge. The guy that owned the building told me he had just sold it. And the city called and said, we need somebody that can come try cases and has had some experience. And, you know, I went. I thought I'd be here a year or two, and I've been here 41 years. So, you know, I found a new area of the law to get involved in. But,
do you think if you hadn't been involved with the Orsini case, this might not have come about?
I don't think the Orsini case had anything to do with it. What happened is that I'd been doing litigation and death penalty cases and federal habeas, and the person who at the time I was given the phone call was the chief deputy in this office. Is the person I've been working against with the AG's office, and she knew that we were honest.
Okay. So how old were you in 1982?
82, I was 30.
30? So, looking back at it now, if you could change anything, if you could go back and say, don't get involved with that case, would you?
Hell yeah.
I mean,
there were a lot of cases where clients would tell me something.
Mm-hmm.
And we would get ready for trial. And if it was really kind of outlandish, I would finally come to the point where I would say, look, let me tell you something. I'm your lawyer. I love you. So I'm going to believe your story. Mm-hmm. And if your mother's in the courtroom, she loves you. But I got to tell you, we're the only two people in the courtroom that are going to believe that story, and I'm not too sure about your mother. And usually I would get something that would approach probably what the truth was.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have made any difference here. I don't know what happened. I don't know why it happened. I've read one of the books, but that was... for ego, I wanted to see if he put in my last line from the closing argument. He didn't. I was really disappointed. George Bentley was going to try to write something about it. I talked to him a lot. He was in the Arkansas Gazette, and he may have been an Arkansas Democrat Gazette reporter. I don't know if he survived the merger or not, but he was trying to put together a lot of information and never really got anywhere with it. You know, it was just a bizarre experience.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, Judge John Langston was dealing with a grand jury, dealing with something, I think, with Sheriff Robinson. I think I did some legal research for him, and then that ended up, something was decided, and then the Arkansas Supreme Court ruled against what the grand jury said of that one. They said something like, you know, gee, this is wrong, but you shouldn't have done that type of thing, and they struck that down. But, you know, I mean, I don't put I did the Orsini case on resumes, and I don't really talk much about it.
Well, I thank you for agreeing to sit down for this. This has been, I've really enjoyed it.